I'm here with Alan Cobb. I'm Bill Teepel, and we're happy to have Donna back in the studio. She was away for some time. And this is Icon Art Radio. Well, everyone knows that I'm an aficionado of black and white anything. That it's a kind of a limited boundary that I love to see artists work within, whether it's black and white drawing or black and white photography or the etching and lithograph world. There's something very unique and moving to me and simplified and almost zen-like about the quality of black and white work. And we were discussing black and white photography and what its destiny will be today, because digital has conquered the field. But I think there will always be a hard, fast group of people that are totally devoted to the black and white photograph. And I was just reflecting on that I do feel the same way about black and white photography that I do about drawing, which I'm extremely obsessed with myself. But I have done the whole thing, the film, black and white film, and the darkroom work, and there's just some romance to it that can't be found anywhere else. And I know that you brought that up, because Donna, go ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, I learned how to do it back when I was in college and had a boyfriend who had darkroom equipment, and I had an apartment that had a big closet. Of course, it was an unventilated closet, and we didn't even think about toxic fumes back in those days in the 60s, and so we would spend hours in this closet with all of our darkroom chemicals. But there was something that appealing to me about producing a work on paper that involved water or liquid. There was something about the liquid element to it that was part of the romance that you just described. And the fact that you had to use this liquid in a precise kind of way also gave it a kind of scientific experiment quality to it and chemistry set quality to it. So there were all kinds of things that mixed together that made spending those 5 hours in a dark room almost like a theatrical event. There was never a feeling of boredom in there. In fact, you would always be shocked at how much time had passed when you finally came out of the room. And so,
and there's something just magic as the image appears on the paper.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or the film, but it's that's a very special moment when that image starts to appear.
Yeah, and it's possible that the young people who've grown up with computer technology feel some sense of romance with working on the computer that I don't feel. But for me, I haven't gotten to a point where I'm able to match that level of losing track of time and feeling completely fascinated by all of the dimensions of what's going on as I did back then. I can't really do it yet with the computer. So you use the computer a lot, Alan. Have you?
Well, for one thing, those of us who did process our own film in a dark room back then were rare. Mm-hmm. Most people never did it and wouldn't want to, and didn't really understand why we wanted to either. But it wasn't like something that everybody could do if they just bothered to pay attention to it, like it is with digital photography. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a digital camera, even grandma, you know. And grandma may not be interested in learning how to print the pictures on her printer, but if she were a little bit interested, she could do that, you know, with 5 minutes of instruction and no rubber gloves and no special additional equipment. So the romance of it is partly the romance of doing something unusual and personal and private and special and
It's similar to the smell of the art studio and the oil paints and the turpentine and all those things. All of these toxic things that we find so romantic. But the smell of the chemicals was as much a part of the charm.
It was a big deal. And there's also that a difference in that there is something magical about having the finished product, which is the print, emerging on the paper under the water, as you were describing, which is not there in the digital process. Mm-hmm. In the digital process, you just wait while the printer goes for a long time, and the thing slowly creeps out, and you can tell that it's being kind of assembled for you mm-hmm. out of little splotches of ink. And that's different. You don't see the totality of the image emerging in the paper. Mm-hmm. You see it being sequentially squirted onto the paper, yeah. which is just a different model feeling, entirely.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like coming out of a dream or something when you're in the dark room. And not to mention, and also the fact that you're doing it under this red light.
Yes, you're doing it on this weird
red light. So it's just it's almost like being on another planet, sure. or in a different world or something. That's very different from the world you normally live in.
You rely on your sense of touch a lot more, and you rely on hearing more, and you're in this environment where there isn't anything to look at, really. Mm-hmm. I remember standing around in my dark room at home for long periods of time waiting for things to finish because I didn't want to go to the trouble of turning out the safe lights and turning on the room lights and then having to do it all over again. Yeah. Partly because my hands were dripping with various stuff that I didn't want to get on everything. But it's really, it's partly the romance of all of that. And of course, it's easy to argue that even that was just a bunch of easy, streamlined stuff compared to real photography, where you get the silver onto the plates yourself, and then you expose them in the view camera, and then you bring them back and develop them, from scratch, without the convenience of film winders and sprocketed 35mm film.
But you can understand why there are people who are obsessed today with doing photography that way.
Well, that's what I mean. It you sort of name your poison. You go as far back in time as you want. Mm-hmm. And the technology, photography started, I think, in 1845. And it's just been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the first couple of generations of photographers did it pretty much the same way. They made their plates and they processed them, and they bought these weird chemicals that nobody ever needed before. I don't know where they got them or why they were available, but eventually it got streamlined and modernized, and then suddenly it switched. And I remember thinking about not being interested in digital myself, and it wasn't really until the previous crop of digital single lens reflex cameras came along that I felt that there was an affordable digital camera, and only barely affordable, that actually worked like my old film camera well enough so that I was willing to give up using film.
So the romance was still there to some degree.
Yes, because, I love handling my DSLRs, and they feel like the same cameras that I was shooting film on.
Well, I think art and the act of creating art and being an artist is available anywhere in any way.
Right.
So we can tune into that.
Right.
But when I hear you talk, I'm almost visualizing two worlds here, almost like the horse and buggy and the modern world of airplanes and cars and stuff. It's like kids today, I think the digital computer world and the iPhone and all of that is just the modern world for them.
It's just given,
And it's so they're finding art and that their own romance, I think, in that.
Or in something different, because that's the stuff that's already there, depending on how old they are.
And there's a back and forth always between, there are always going to be people who are into like retro things, and there are always going to be people who are into the most cutting edge, advanced things. Right. And like, I knew I was going to be able to bring this sometime into this because I wanted to. I've been reading Julia Child's book about her life in France and how she first got into cooking, And it's just like so interesting to me because, I mean, I myself am very interested in French cooking, and because of being over there and kind of, and I think of myself as a good French cook, but I don't come even an iota close to the level that she got to. She described herself as a mad scientist, and literally she was. She was so enamored of this art form of French cooking that even after she had taken the course at the Cordon Bleu and learned all of their techniques, she had to just like do it on her own in her own kitchen, where she would try a recipe literally hundreds of times, tweaking it slightly this way and slightly that way. And one example she uses in the book is learning how to make homemade mayonnaise. And she made it like over and over again, 100 or so times, changing it a little, until she finally felt like she got it perfect and could make a recipe and put it in her cookbook. And so she sent this recipe out to a whole bunch of friends back in the States to have them try it and give her feedback on it. And not one person actually wanted to take the trouble to make it. And so, you know, obviously she knew at that time that a lot of these procedures she was going through were for recipes that nobody else was going to want to actually do, because they weren't a mad scientist who was madly in love with this process. However, it was still worth it to her to do that, because that's where her love was. That's what was romantic to her, to go to that fine degree of just like trial and error. Let's try this. She never got bored, like we did in the dark room when we would try making a print and then we would say, oh, but if I exposed it just for like one more half a second, how would that look, you know? And if I burned off this corner, you know, how would that look? And,
yeah.
So it doesn't matter what aspect of life you're acting in, these same principles are true. You know, whatever gets you going and inspires you, whether it's a modern, like these food artists now who use really bizarre scientific methods to make unusual food, and there's whole restaurants that deal with these kinds of unusual foods. It's pretty much the same thing that Julia Child did, going back in time and trying and studying the old traditional methods.
I have a friend who's very much into black and white photography, and also he prefers shooting on film. He no longer wants to do the processing himself, and I guess there's still in Toronto a place where he can get fine art quality black and white processing done. So he goes around shooting on old Leicas on black and white film and using all these strange old Leica lenses. But there's also an entire school, a rather large school of photography that is totally into black and white photography, but totally digital.
Mm-hmm.
They buy specific models of Epson printers and specific sets of inks, and these are color printers, but they're set up with several shades of gray ink so that they can get a particularly accurate reproduction of the gamut of black and white print paper. And there are websites full of enthusiasts who are, you know, excitedly refining their techniques in producing digital black and white prints that are as indistinguishable as possible from the finest black and white photographic prints. And yet they're using the latest cameras and Photoshop and all the other technology to make their images.
But this is bringing up the issue that I raised in the beginning, that there's a particular art form that has to do
with
the value.
Yeah.
Art form that's limited within the range of value.
Yeah.
Particularly black, white, and gray, as opposed to, you know, sepia tone. But that's another thing, too.
Yeah, sure.
Totally
or duotone.
Sepia tone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm quite obsessed with it myself. Even Janet tells me, well, why don't you introduce a little color into your drawings? And to me, that's like blasphemy, you know?
Sure. I just imagined
so she's seeing something else. There's some other art form that's in her mind.
Yeah.
But it's not black and white, because that would the integrity of the drawings I do would be completely obscured sure. by any amount of color, because it's within that those limitations that it exists. And what it, I believe that they build color in your mind, because these people that sure. that work in photography this way and have the six different grays and blacks and stuff that they're working with in their printer, they're sensitive to the feeling of each
yeah.
tone in yeah. the in, and I feel that in my drawings I'm quite aware that the of warmness and coolness and the quality of the graphite that I'm using, and it
right.
it builds reality within a certain dream world that's a yeah. black and white yeah. world.
Have you ever read that Japanese book called Shadow and Light?
I have seen it, but it's so of the past, it's so vague, you're going to have to like remind me.
Well, I don't have a, I mean, it was a while ago when I read it as well, but it really brings your attention to the beauty specifically of using shadow and light in art forms in a room, you know, when you're placing a light source, or that the shadow is just as important as the light, and you have to really consider the relationship mm-hmm. between the light and the shadow, and your drawings do that, and black and white photography that we've been talking about also does that. It just, and what you don't, it's sort of like when we were having the show where we talked about the effect of sounds in the background and how sometimes we're just comfortable in a place and we're not even aware that the reason why we are is because the sounds are pleasant and all of that. It's the same thing with lighting in an atmosphere, that if you are in a place where there's very harsh light and very hard shadows, it doesn't feel as nice as in a, as if you're in a place where there's a lot of range, large range of darks to lights and all the tones in between. And when you're, and in your drawings, you evoke that. You're actually doing drawings of moonlight, and that's the feeling you get when you're outside in bright moonlight. You have that quality all around you of very, very dark corners of, you know,
it's right. I don't know. I've never really talked much about this. Now I'm realizing yeah. I have a complete obsession almost with black and white. And I rejected it for many years because there was some idea that black wasn't a good thing. You were supposed to be into pastels and lovely, beautiful things. And I realized I was in love with black and white film. I like film noir, cinema, mm-hmm. The black and, I don't know if we've ever, I just love black and white cinema.
Yeah.
So you're coming
in the
right
same
here
way.
The
it's all in the same. And then yeah. walking at night, one of my favorite things is enjoying nature at night.
Yeah.
And it's totally that black and white world,
yeah.
pretty much. Subtle qualities of color.
Yeah. I tried a couple of summers ago very hard to take photographs of what I saw at night around my house. And I couldn't do it. There's no way to photograph it because there's no light. And if you expose long enough so that there is enough light, then it doesn't look like it's night.
Yeah, yeah. That's
so there's, in a sense, there's just no way to capture it unless you go into the realm of just being more creative and not actually capturing it.
Or tweaking it in the dark room or whatever,
yeah.
you know, to make it
and
look
so
like one.
Bill can evoke it yeah. through you know, pencil drawings in a way that the camera is helpless to yeah. compete with. It doesn't, it can't even begin to do it.
I was really astonished one time when someone took my photograph on a full moon night with a long exposure, and I was really eager to see the picture. I thought it was going to be so cool, and actually it just looked like I was standing there in the daytime.
That's right.
Like, no,
there's nothing funnier than those old movies where they've shot them in the daytime and
yeah.
then they make it, I mean, I suppose, I don't know.
Yeah, they used to just use
the
blue,
nighttime films are shot.
A blue filter.
Yeah, oh. right,
and you
right.
see cars going by with their headlights on, you know, and their headlights are these dim little things.
Funny. Well, it's interesting, Bill, when you were talking about your fascination with black and white, and then how Janet or somebody wanted you to add color to your work, and how in picturing your particular work in color, it does seem, I mean, you said it seemed blasphemous to you, but it does seem hard to picture.
Seems horrible to me.
It would have a completely different effect.
Yeah, I've considered a different angle on it, which is to do oil paint or watercolor and actually incorporate color.
Oh, sure, do tiny little color pictures.
But the drawings themselves are like
they're
adding a little color to a Rembrandt etching or something.
It sounds really horrible.
Well, and you find that out.
it's totally
sure
outside the realm.
Something in mind that wasn't quite as horrible as what I'm visualizing.
But it's like I used to do a lot of black and white pen and ink work.
Right.
Really
Same
tiny
black
details.
Black and white pen and ink is also another there's something pure about these art forms.
Or colored pencils. You know, there's things you can do with colored pencils that are magnificent.
Well, color, I mean, I'm mostly working color now, but back then I worked mainly in black and white. But my mom wanted wanted a print of one of my black and white pen and ink drawings, but she wanted me to color it in, like hand color it with watercolor or something. And I did, and I absolutely hated it.
Another art form.
Yeah.
There's something about this black and white thing that is, I don't know why it's so fulfilling. I get the same thing from, you know, Japanese ink drawings. There's something about the color work, though, that's in the Chinese landscape that it approaches it in subtlety, because they stay within this limited range of the sepia tone or the bluish tone or something, but it's usually a very subtle use of color, and it's mostly value that's revealing the imagery.
Yeah. Well, because what you said, I think the crucial thing is it's a limited range, because if you're setting yourself that kind of a boundary, then what you have to get your depth in a different way than if you're working in color, where you have like a much broader range of possibilities. It's like pieces of music that are just, you know, one single instrument doing something instead of a big symphony. It's trickier, in a way, to get the same kind of fullness and depth and beauty that you get when you have, you know, all these instruments playing together. But when you hear somebody who's skillful at doing that, it's amazing to hear.
I just thought of someone performing a Bach partita on solo violin, and then adding a little piano. Adding a little percussion.
It's like that, and I'm very fond of limiting that.
Black and white is luminance without chrominance.
Right.
I mean, we learn from video, effect, that you can take out the saturation, the color, you know, saturation information, and you still have an image, which is sort of remarkable in a way. But we have these sensors in our eyes that are not color sensitive, and they don't differentiate color at all, and they're the majority. So to perceive with rods instead of with cones or rods and cones is something that happens naturally when the light is very subdued. And it's something we are familiar with, and it's not really alien to us to be looking at something that has no color, even though we theoretically live in a world of color.
Now, I've always had some trouble with the jump between black and white photography and color photography. I have accepted color photography as a completely valid art form, and I've had beautiful aesthetic experiences off of it. But it's almost crass to me compared to black and white photography, and I really dislike putting them together in the same exhibit. I allowed these photographers at one point to kind of half curate their own show, because one was a very famous photographer from New York, and what they came up with was a mixture of the two, and it was almost jarring to me to see the two things together.
Yeah.
It was similar to adding the color to my drawings, that experience.
Well, it's like sampling a really fine piece of cheese and then sampling a really nice Thanksgiving dinner. You know, so, okay. I'm not sure that you can compare them. They're just two different worlds.
Yeah. And
in one case, you're really looking at subtleties, and in another case, you're looking at a spectrum of subtleties, but the spectrum itself isn't subtle at all.
Well, and any good artist is going to be able to produce subtlety and range and everything, no matter what the art form. It's like, I really loved lithography in art school. And again, it was sort of like the romance of the darkroom, because there was this great big stone that we worked on, you know, this gorgeous great big stone that we worked on. And I just loved that thing. And I would have become a lithographer. It was my favorite art form, except for the fact that I couldn't imagine myself having to get one of those big stones and all this, you know, stand that you had it on and everything, and haul it around with me everywhere I went. And so I didn't go into that as an art form.
That's why I'd never got a Hammond B3.
But yeah, it's just like, but there was some, whenever I see lithographs, and gorgeous.
I was into etching too.
Yeah.
Which wasn't quite as romantic as the stone, although I love the look. Mm-hmm. I was very fond of the delicate line work, which you wouldn't get as much in lithography. But that whole thing, color photographs, black and white theater, or cinema, the drawings, the etching, it's all of that relates more as a whole to me than their differences. I put all of those things together into a beautiful realm of black and white art.
Isn't it interesting that cinema verite was black and white?
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it more real to be black and white than it is to be in color? In a way, it is. It's almost like reading is more real than movies.
Because you add more to it.
Yeah.
That's another subject that we, for another show.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.